Hey folks, Scott Horton here for Veterans for Peace at veteransforpeace.org. I'm not a vet, but if you are, I'd like to ask you to consider joining Veterans for Peace. As you know, in matters of foreign wars, a veteran's voice is given much more weight. Well, Veterans for Peace is making veterans' voices heard in ways and places where they can really make a difference. There are more than 175 chapters of Veterans for Peace in all 50 states, working hard to eliminate nuclear weapons, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and abolish war as an instrument of American national policy. It's the peace vets versus the chicken hawks. Join up the good fight at veteransforpeace.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here. After the show, you should check out one of my sponsors, WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by Mike Swanson, a former hedge fund manager who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Mike's site, WallStreetWindow.com, is unique in that he shows people what he's really investing in, updating you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike's betting his positions are going to go up due to the Federal Reserve printing all that money to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane, at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Number sign Scott Horton Show is my chat room. And / Scott Horton Show is my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. That's all I got to say about all that. Next guest is Gareth Porter. He is the intrepid journalist from Interpress Service and also truthout.org and pretty much fairly certain all of it's reprinted at original.antiwar.com/Porter. And I interview him about everything because it's all very interesting stuff. And it's almost always debunking war party lies or at least helping me get my act together about the issues most important to me, such as, for example, the pretended controversy over Iran's nuclear program and Israel's constant threats to get the United States of America into a war with them about it. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How in the hell are you?
I'm fine. Thanks, Scott. I'm glad to be back.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here. So, the latest, it's in the top news headlines today at antiwar.com. Netanyahu's 2010 order was not a move to war on Iran. And this is in reference to that story that was in, what, in Ynet, right? About, well, go ahead and tell us.
That was the original press story, but it was really about a program that was broadcast on Channel 2 in Israel. An investigative program that I believe it was a half hour, if I'm not mistaken, was devoted to this episode in 2010 regarding Netanyahu, Defense Minister Barak on one side, and Gabi Ashkenazi, the IDF chief, and Meir Dagan, the Mossad chief, on the other.
Mm-hmm. All right. So do tell, first of all, what was in there, and then what's the controversy that you got to set straight the discrepancy here?
Right. Well, let me begin with the controversy, if I may, which is that the news coverage of the story that was told in that Israeli program has made it sound like that Prime Minister Netanyahu actually gave an order to prepare for war with Iran, meaning that he intended to go to war. That was certainly the impression that was conveyed. In fact, I quote a blogger for The Atlantic saying precisely that, that, well, this shows us that, in fact, Netanyahu was more willing, more ready to go to war with Iran than we had previously thought. And I think that that summarizes the general impression that was created by the news coverage, by and I cite the Reuters, AP, and AFP stories, as well as the blog on the Atlantic, just to support the idea that this story has been interpreted as reinforcing this whole storyline, this narrative, if you will, that Netanyahu has in fact been ready to go to war against Iran, and that that threat to go to war against Iran is still in fact a serious problem. This is a theme that, as you know, I've talked about on your show many times, a number of times now, and have suggested that that this is misleading, that in fact we need to be thinking about Netanyahu as not somebody who has been ready to go to war, but who has used the idea that he's ready to go to war for his own political diplomatic maneuvering.
Now, so
I
do
think
you
this
think
fits
that,
into that.
Do you think that the pro-Likud, pro-war party are the ones behind this leak, actually? This is just part of that bluff?
No, I think that the...
or this is just journalism by people who bought into the bluff.
Well, I think the episode... we have to distinguish between the coverage of the episode in the news media and the original Channel 2 program, which I think was, a reasonably accurate portrayal, as accurate as you can get by interviewing the key figures in it. And I think my key point here is that the program itself, as a reflection of what those four figures were saying, tells a very different story than what we're getting from the mass media coverage of it. And what the program actually showed is that what Netanyahu did was to order to sort of spring on the IDF chief Gabi Ashkenazi and Meir Dagan the idea of raising the alert level to the highest level that's known about, which apparently was called F+, and to do so with the intention, I mean, this was not explicit, but it was implicit in the way in which it was discussed by certainly Ashkenazi himself, not directly in the program, but clearly on background, he was being quoted as talking about this, saying that what was really going on here was that Netanyahu didn't understand the implications, the full implications of putting the IDF on such a high state of alert, which Ashkenazi pointed out, again, on background, not to be directly quoted, was that the danger was that the Iranians would get wind of this high level of alert, state of readiness to go to war, and would do something to preempt.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, in fact, both Ashkenazi and Dagan, as I point out in my story, were not only extremely troubled by this, were you know obviously very much opposed to doing this, but regarded the team of Netanyahu and Barak as irresponsible and you know, to the point where they should no longer be leading the country. And now we have a clear idea, really, of why Dagan, when he quit, or was fired, or whatever, left his position as director of Mossad in late 2010, went really on a public campaign, starting in mid 2011, basically attacking Netanyahu as somebody who shouldn't be leading the country. I mean, because he found that Netanyahu was guilty of just, you know, basically the most irresponsible kind of behavior in his maneuvering, in his trying to use this alert to try to suggest that he was being tough. That's the bottom line, the most fundamental reality that I think is reflected in the program. There are other aspects of it as well. I mean, one of which I think is a very important one, that both sides, both the Netanyahu-Barak side, as represented by Barak, and the Ashkenazi-Dagan side, were in agreement that Israel did not have a viable military option, did not have a military option that could be successful in attacking Iran. And that's one of the things that was pointed out by Ashkenazi at that meeting, according to the program. And Ashkenazi, of course, again, being a key source for that. And Barak did not deny the fact that there was no real military option, a genuine military option. Of course, he could send Israeli planes to attack Iran, but it would not be a successful operation, and everybody knew it. And that was implicit in what Barak responded, which was to blame Ashkenazi for not having prepared an adequate option, a military option for Israel, which is really quite an interesting development here, that now it's out in the open, that everybody agrees that Israel did not have a military option that made any sense.
Mm-hmm. All right, so there's a few things I need to go over here, and if you have more points that you can draw out of this story, I want to hear them. But first of all, I just want to make sure, sum up and see if I got you right here. You're saying that this story, that the basic point of the story, a bunch of people got wrong. They missed the part where the head of the army, of the Israeli army, said, no, I don't want to do this bluff, basically taking them to DEFCON 1.
Right.
Because it might come true. We might actually get into a war if we pretend like we're getting into a war. And
that,
so I don't want to fake it.
That was the basis, the primary basis on which they said, no, this is crazy. You don't want to do this. And of course,
a bunch of journalists said, wow, Netanyahu almost took Israel to war then, but missed the truth that was revealed there, which was that no, he wasn't. He was just bluffing, but his own people stopped him from his bluff because
exactly.
It was such a dangerous one.
You've precisely stated, I think, the key point here.
Okay. And then, secondly, I believe you're saying that it's Mayor Dagan or Dagan, whatever, the former head of Mossad, he's the one who's behind this story because he's trying to get across to the people of Israel that you cannot trust this clown Netanyahu with this power because he doesn't know what the hell he's doing, man. I had to stop him from getting us into a war accidentally one time.
I think that's a fair statement to make, although certainly Ashkenazi was very much in tune with that and may have been, you know, explicitly involved with Dagan in getting the story out. Who knows exactly how that happened? But both of them were certainly very much in favor of getting this story out. Although Ashkenazi, again, did not want to be quoted directly, they quoted sources close to Ashkenazi, which means Ashkenazi himself.
Right, yeah. Well, and, you know, because it could go the other way, too, right, where Netanyahu is just sitting there drinking his whiskey and going, tell him I'm crazy, Henry, tell him I'll nuke him, you know?
Well, I mean, that would be, yes, I agree that he's all in favor of stories that make it look like he's the tough guy and he's ready to go to war. In this case, of course, I think the actual story itself does not make that point. It makes a different point, although
right.
I'm sorry to say that the difference between the two is too subtle for most news media to really pick up on.
Right.
And I have to add that it's not that in at least some cases, you know, if you go far enough down in the story, you see that in fact what happened was that he was ordering the highest level of alert rather than actually ordering a war against Iran. But the problem is that, I mean, that distinction is so important, it should have been highlighted, and none of the stories really did that.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I think you and I have been talking about this for who knows how many years now, the fact that, as you were just illustrating, this story helps to illustrate there is no Israeli military option against Iran's nuclear program, their stated target whatsoever. Never mind regime change or anything completely fanciful like that. But even when it comes to launching a unilateral preventive war against Iran's nuclear program, they just can't do it, meaning that if there is such a thing at all, as a Israeli military plan for war with Iran, it's simply a war to get America to do it. And then, but you know, kind of that, subset
right.
of that
and is
whether
that
is or not
the
they would
we...
dare to drag us in by doing something so drastic that the Iranians would have no choice but to strike back Israeli and American targets, and then by that way drag us in kicking and screaming. You know, does Netanyahu have anything like that amount of chutzpah to try that?
Well, yeah, this is a danger that we've both talked about in the past few years, and indeed did appear for a long time to me to be the key danger that we face in regard to the whole Iran nuclear scare. That's what I'm calling it now. I think now that the events of the past several months, i.e. the showdown, if you will, between Netanyahu and Obama, which really ended with Netanyahu backing down and basically crawling away with his tail between his legs, in effect. He failed in his effort to put pressure on Obama, sufficient to get Obama to even come close to going along with his scheme, basically for an ultimatum, that the United States would make an ultimatum to the Iranians that if they didn't close down their nuclear program within a date certain, by a date certain, that the United States would attack Iran. And that was so far out of any possible, you know, any possibility for the Obama administration to accept that Obama came out very clearly saying absolutely not, and I'm going to make it clear that you're way out of line by refusing to even see you when you come to the United States, which is exactly what happened. And I think since those events have unfolded, and then, you know, you had Netanyahu going to the United Nations and giving a speech which was noted for primarily for its cartoon presentation of the issue, but also significantly involved no threat, even implied threat by Netanyahu of a unilateral attack on Iran. I think, from my point of view, that ended the effective life of the Netanyahu bluff of attacking Iran. So I think that we are now no longer in a situation where this idea that the danger of a Netanyahu provoking of a war to involve the United States is really even semi-realistic.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't count broadly speaking, but at least on the Iran issue, Obama sort of kind of just ran on he kept us out of war, though all options are on the table. But if history's any guide, that means that he wants to go ahead and do it. And if The Guardian is any guide, and Julian Borger in The Guardian, who I take seriously when he writes stuff, you may know him better than me, but he's reporting that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is telling the Israelis, hey, pipe down about this strike Iran thing. You're going to make it more difficult for us to do it.
I had not seen that, actually. Sorry.
Oh, really?
This is one that escaped me.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I'll send that right on.
How is he saying that the any Israeli belligerence about Iran makes it more difficult for the United States? I hadn't seen that.
Well, I'll have to click on the thing here.
Okay.
Where are you, Borger? I'm looking in the Google News. It's letting me down so far here. Wait a minute.
That's okay.
Is about a week old. And, of course, I that's so important because Dempsey came out. That's... the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was the guy who said, I, meaning the United States of America, do not want to be complicit
any
Israeli war with Iran. And we took that like, yeah, Obama, slap him down, tell Netanyahu to shut up. But then...
Well, and absolutely, and that's the way it was interpreted within Israel. There's no question about that. In any case, I mean, I would just say as a general matter that this whole idea that the United States is still has a... all options are on the table is simply, the most formalistic and non-credible kind of threat, if you will, if you want to call it a threat, which I just don't think it's serious. I mean, it's a couple of steps down from the Bush administration, which we all recall, the use of the term all options are on the table. And it should be understood that, and Netanyahu is using the same language. That's the extent of his threat, that all options are on the table. It has been for months.
Right.
And that is the lowest conceivable level of of threat. You can't get any less threatening than to say all options are on the table, because it doesn't really tell you anything.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, as I've pointed out,
by the way,
in stories, you know, it's important to understand that the previous administration, the Ehud Olmert administration, was actually more explicitly threatening by far than anything that has come out of the Netanyahu administration.
Right.
That is to say, they did say, you know, if the Iranians don't stop their nuclear program, we will attack them.
Right. Olmert to Netanyahu is like Khatami to Ahmadinejad, right? He looks like he's not as violent or whatever. He doesn't. But Netanyahu just exudes that radicalism that scares the hell out of him.
There's some similarity there, although lots of differences as well. But yeah, he definitely kind of sounds like he's much more belligerent, but in fact he has not been more belligerent. And, you know, except for that one episode that we started out discussing, which clearly was irresponsible and belligerent, but not with the intention of actually going to war.
Mm. All right. Now, by the way, the article here, I found it. It's U.S. warns Israel off preemptive strike on Iran. It's from Halloween, October 31st. And the first paragraph reads, U.S. military commanders have warned their Israeli counterparts that any action against Iran would severely limit the ability of American forces in the region to mount their own operations against the Iranian nuclear program by cutting off vital logistics support from Gulf Arab allies. In other words, you know, if it needs to be done,
that's an obvious argument for them to make. I wouldn't read anything into it that it somehow confirms or supports the idea that there is any serious thought being given to the use of military force. Now, you know, that is not to say that the U.S. military does not believe that if Iran were to make a decision to go for nuclear weapon, that all bets would be off. But clearly, short of that, no one in the U.S. military, in any position of authority in the U.S. military, has any thought about using military force against Iran. Simply,
well, if anything, does this indicate that Dempsey and the generals really are that worried about Ehud Barak and Benjamin Netanyahu doing this thing, if they have to keep telling them over and over again to pipe down about it?
That's hard for me to say what their assessment is of the Netanyahu posture, whether it's real or bluff. My guess is that they aren't sure, that they suspect that it's a bluff, but they regard it as the better part of prudence for them to continue to keep putting pressure on Netanyahu over this issue. And perhaps also, it is in line with their own thinking, and it makes them look good, from some point of view. It gives them a patina of statesmanship to be taking that position somehow.
All right, now, so what are your prospects for successful talks and a real agreement and defusing of this Iranian nuclear scare, as you so aptly characterize it?
Well, I think that now that Obama has been reelected with a substantial mandate, in political terms, I mean, you know, not in terms of the popular vote, but in terms of the practical, power realities of U.S. politics, that we are in a situation where there's every reason to, you know, for the president to be saying, okay, this is the time for me to make a diplomatic move. There's no more reason for me to hold off. The Israeli problem is really under control, and my domestic political problem should not be holding me back. I think the only constraining factor at this point, there are two constraining factors, and they are significant, and they need to be recognized. One, of course, is that at the center of the diplomatic problem of Iran is the question of sanctions, and who is it in the United States government that controls the sanctions? It's the U.S. Congress. And who controls the U.S. Congress on sanctions? It's AIPAC. And so, you know, this is definitely a political constraint on what Obama can do in terms of taking a flexible position in the negotiations on the issue of the economic financial sanctions that have been levied against Iran, particularly, of course, the ones on the oil sector that were enacted last year or earlier this year. So that's a constraint, and the president can try to get around that by using his authority to waive sanctions, but still, you know, in order to really remove the problem, to be able to make a deal, I think he has to have congressional support. The only other thing that the president can do is to appeal to the Europeans to agree that they would give up their sanctions as part of a deal. Now, at one level, one would think that the Europeans would be much more willing to do that than the United States. That has been the case in the past, of course. Going back to the Bush administration, it was the Europeans who were trying to negotiate a deal with the Iranians, whereas the Bush administration was saying, no, we're not really in favor of that. But now, over the last few years, the Europeans have been actually harder line in their policy toward Iran, in their diplomatic stance toward Iran, than the Obama administration. So that might be problematic. And furthermore, you know, of course, the headlines in recent weeks have been about the question of whether there have been talks about secret talks. Secret talks one-on-one between the United States and Iran. And
well,
no
one
doubt,
report even had it that the First Lady's best friend was sent over there. What the hell
Valerie
is that?
Jarrett, yeah, I doubt that. I doubt that very much. Who knows? But, I mean, why would you need Valerie Jarrett to do that? If you want to have one-on-one talks with Iran, you don't need to bring somebody, you know, from somebody who's playing a different role in the White House just because she happens to speak some Farsi.
Yeah, I mean, even if you don't trust Hillary Clinton to get the job done anymore, you still can pick someone else at the White House than the First Lady's
chief of staff. Yeah,
I
mean, that story just doesn't add up for me. I don't have any inside dope.
Anyway, well, I'm sorry for interrupting
sense.
You. Go ahead then.
Well,
about these
the point I was going to make is that, you know, now that the question of one-on-one U.S.-Iran talks has been brought up, has been mooted, and it looks like that is the direction things are going to move. The Europeans could, you know, very well feel they're being cut out of the action, and so you have this contradiction built into the situation that the United States would need the Europeans' help to make a deal with the Iranians on sanctions. And that, of course, gives the Europeans additional leverage on the U.S. negotiating position. So that is a potential constraint that I think we need to be concerned with in the coming months.
All right, we got to go. We're over time. Thanks very much for your time, as always, Gareth. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott, as always. Bye-bye.
Everybody, that's the great Gareth Porter from Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. ipsnews.net. You can also find his award-winning work at truthout.org and, of course, antiwar.com/Porter. We'll be right back with Phil Giralli right after this.
Ben Franklin said those who are willing to sacrifice essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither. Hi, Scott Horton here for the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's a playing card-sized steel Bill of Rights designed to set off the metal detectors anywhere the police state goes, so you can remind those around you the freedoms we've lost. And for a limited time, get free shipping when you purchase a frequent flyer pack of 5 Bill of Rights Security Edition cards. Play a leading role in the security theater with a Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Join the great Jacob Hornberger and some of the best writers in the libertarian movement like James Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more for a real individualist take on the most important matters of peace, liberty, and prosperity in our society. That's the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org.
Hey y'all, Scott here. As you know, I've been laid off from antiwar.com, and I've embarked on a mission to make this show into a real business. And as you can tell, I've been doing all right at lining up some sponsors, and some great ones at that. But it isn't enough, so the perpetual fund drive rolls on. The Scott Horton Show needs donors and more advertisers if the show is to outlast my meager savings. So please, stop by scotthorton.org/donate. You can make single donations or sign up for a monthly subscription with PayPal.
You don't need an account with them to do so. Or use Google Wallet, WePay.com, Give.org, and now even accepting Bitcoins. And if you own or represent a company or organization interested in sponsoring the show, please email scott@scotthorton.org so we can work it out. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And thanks. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.